Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne here. Have you ever had a moment of existential crisis? Not exactly depression, though it probably feels really depressing, but something more philosophical. Feeling like there's just no reason to believe, no reason really to exist. Years ago, Jeff Schloss had that experience, and it took him in an unexpected direction.
I was reading C.S. Lewis, and I frankly found him unpersuasive and a little irritating that he would think his arguments were adequate. And I read Why I'm Not a Christian, unpersuaded, and I actually despaired of reason being able to solve these questions. I was laying in my bed one night and decided to pray to a God who I wasn't sure was there. I give up. Reason's never going to solve it. And in that moment, the most glorious, numinous, loving, overwhelming personal presence that I had ever experienced or even ever imagined flooded my heart and filled the room.
Jeff Schloss became a Christian, and what's unusual is that he's also a scientist, an evolutionary biologist, which has led him over the years to ask some interesting questions about religion, like why it exists, and whether believing in God, any God, is an evolutionary advantage. Also, how far science can actually go in explaining the unexplainable. Jeff stopped by our studio recently to talk with Steve Paulson.
So, Jeff, there have been various efforts, especially in recent years, and especially among evolutionary biologists, to explain the origins of religion. Is this a question that science can answer?
Well, that's itself a great question, and it's one that science, at least evolutionary sciences, had not attempted to answer until very recently. I think the questions of, twofold questions of, is there a biological basis or a cognitive disposition toward religious belief? For sure, that's a question that science can answer. And the second question, is there any adaptive value to religious belief and practice? Well, we answer that about virtually every other human and non-human behavior. So those are fair questions. Mm-hmm. Let's start there.
Okay.
Fair questions.
Okay. Well, let's talk about those two things. So the cognitive apparatus to have religious belief. Obviously, a lot of people have various religious beliefs, and there's something about the brain that seems to give us that capacity.
So there's some fascinating debates right now. The next question is are these beliefs kind of purely culturally constructed, or are there innate dispositions to believe certain things with religious salience? And that's a really fascinating debate. Here's where I think things are. So there's some work that suggests we're naturally disposed to theism. And there's some very legitimate criticisms of that work. What does seem to be empirically well established is that even children, in the absence of religious instruction, appear to be naturally disposed to certain beliefs that are related to theism but aren't full-blown theism.
Give me an example.
Yeah, the notion that there's something about life that transcends the material and endures after death. So you put a snake and a rat in a box, and you ask the children who's in the box, the rat and the snake, and you've told them beforehand they're both hungry. And the box shakes, and now you ask the children, who's in the box? And they'll say, well, just the snake. Where's the rat? Well, the snake ate the rat. Is the rat hungry? Yes. So they have this sense of aspects of life or personhood that endure post-body. Psychologist at Yale, Paul Bloom, calls them natural-born dualists. But that's not the same as an afterlife belief. Mm-hmm. So it's not the same as an explicitly formulated doctrine like reincarnation or resurrection and life in heaven or ancestor worship. So my own view, and I think this reflects the kind of the consensus of the literature, is there are natural dispositions to believe in certain ideas that are related to religion, but are not overtly religious.
Is this another way of saying that the brain seems to be hardwired in some ways so that we can easily believe some of these kinds of things?
Okay, I love that you asked that question. And I would say, I don't want to be too waffly here, but I'd say kind of. And the reason is that that all phenotypes, all biological characteristics are gene by environment interactions. So I'm a little bit hesitant to use the term innate or hardwired, as if every human being in every context is going to wind up with the same kind of mind.
Right. And obviously, what we believe is going to be mediated by the culture that we grow up in, the family that we grow up in, all of that.
And even our dispositions to believe certain kinds of things will be mediated. But yes, bottom line, for most people, in most situations of nurture and cultural upbringing, it looks like there's a disposition to, as you say, look for causal explanations, but also look for final causes, for teleological explanations, to think, at least initially, of life as involving something beyond matter as well as our bodies.
Okay, so you said there's another big question when it comes to what can science tell us about the origins of religion, and that is there adaptive value
right.
to religion? Because, you know, we know that to join various religious groups, there's a cost that comes to that. You got to do a lot of stuff to be sort of a member of that faith in good standing. And the question is, why go to all that trouble?
Absolutely. That's really an exciting question these days. And that question itself has two parts. I mean, one question is what we were just talking about. If there are developmentally natural dispositions to belief, are those adaptive? And so some people say, no, they're not adaptive. They're byproducts of other dispositions that are adaptive. But the whole religious thing is not adaptive. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
So one of my colleagues, Justin Barrett, talks about our hypersensitive agency detecting device, HAD, that all of us have agency detectors. And by the way, this looks like it emerges very early on. Even infants make the distinction between animate and inanimate objects. And it makes sense. We got to avoid predators and snakes. And some people argue that, well, it's better to jump out of the way of a snake that isn't there than to fail to jump out of the way of a snake who is there. So our agency detection devices are tuned to be a little hypersensitive. And so we may end up seeing agents that aren't there, maybe even spirits and ancestors and gods. But that's just a byproduct. Actually thinking that there are spirits or gods isn't adaptive. The adaptive thing is jumping out of the way of snakes that aren't there. And there are others who say, no, we have an innate disposition to believe in these beings. And it is adaptive. It becomes especially adaptive when we endow these beings with moral salience, when they're not just having parties on a sacred mountain, but when they're paying attention to the affairs of humans.
They're watching over us.
Watching over us and rewarding good behavior and punishing bad behavior. And what that does is, it's one more evolved mechanism of stabilizing cooperation in a highly social species in which defection needs to be controlled and in which trust needs to be promoted.
So, I mean, so you can see the logic here. I mean, these religious beliefs would help people bond within a group. You know, you share certain values and beliefs, you participate in the same rituals, you're rewarded for cooperating with each other, you develop a group identity.
Yeah, you develop a group identity, and that's a great point, Steve. I mean, one version of this is that that's kind of all religion does. It could be, well, like joining a fraternity or being a part of a sports team or having a particular tattoo. It's just an emblem or an icon of group identity.
I mean, if you really push this, I mean, you could say, you know, rabid soccer fans.
Yes.
I don't know, like those who follow Manchester United, is that basically the same thing as devout religious belief?
Well, actually, some folks say the basic social tools being used there are the same things. They involve rituals, many times rituals which are costly, like hazing in a fraternity or a sports team. It involves rituals that require learning. You have to be some level of commitment to learn them. So some people say, yeah, there's really not much difference there. Others, they'd say, no, these social tools are common to sports teams and fraternities, but there's something else here. The specific beliefs actually do work. That if you're committed, if you really believe that there is a moralizing deity that's watching your actions, you're going to behave in a different way. And that amplifies the opportunity for deep social commitment.
Basically, you're going to feel coercion. Maybe that's probably not the right word, but you're going to feel pressure in some way. Maybe it's just generated by yourself to do good.
Yeah. So I love it that you said that. The prevailing view right now is that you actually feel pressure not to do bad. The kind of consensus view amongst those who think that belief does real work, that it's not just an add-on to these social technologies, that punishing gods prevent defection. I actually am working on a project now, though, that takes seriously your proposal that belief in moralizing deities, and it doesn't have to be a deity, it could be karma, it could be any kind of moral structure of the universe, does exercise a check on defection, but it also generates motivation to do good. And I wouldn't say pressure to do good. I would say invitation to do good. Maybe the sense that, whether it's an illusion or not, the sense that we have been loved, embraced, maybe even forgiven by a loving moral deity might generate gratitude, might generate faith that I can take a particular risk on behalf of another and it not ruin my life because God's watching out for me.
Okay, so we've been trying to come up with these evolutionary explanations for why people might be religious. What about transcendence? What about the experience that some people report of revelation or of the experience of the numinous? Does that figure into any of this?
Boy, this is a real-time conversation, so I get to be delighted at the questions you ask. And I have to say, in the literature over the last 20 years or so, which is just emerging, there's been a lot of anthropological and psychological literature on religious experience, but there's been very little evolutionary treatments of that question.
But how can you not talk about that? Isn't that sort of the essence of religious experience?
I happen to think so. I think that's the big question that we need to address in evolutionary theories. And one of the proposals that I'm working on with some colleagues right now is that this notion that you brought up early of costly rituals, that, well, shoot, if you have people that are brought together, they have identity and shared belief, they have increased trust in one another because they believe that everyone believes in the same God, you could have somebody who games the system who doesn't really believe in that God. So my colleague at University of Connecticut, Rich Sosis, has done a lot of work on costly rituals. And Rich argues that—
Like sacrificing animals, for instance.
Sacrificing animals or cutting off the end of your male genital or not doing any work 1 out of 7 days of the week. There are all sorts of religious rituals that have real costs. And Rich has suggested that these costly rituals are honest signs of commitment to the religious system. So I'm with him so far on that. And he's even found that communities that have these costly rituals endure longer than communities that don't. But now here's the next question that leads to your question about religious experience. You could game that system too. You could calculate the costs and see that, well, shoot, I don't believe, but what the heck, I'm going to get more out of the system if I do these. I'll gain more than it costs me. I think politicians do that all the time when they do things like go to church. But they might not believe, but they know they're not going to get elected to office if they don't go. So here's the last stage. Are there some signals that aren't necessarily costly, but that are very, very hard to fake? Just because they're not consciously developed. So my colleague David Sloan Wilson, who I think you talked with recently, he's done work on laughter. It's really hard to fake a laugh and get away with it. You kind of have to get the joke.
Right.
And it may be, I happen to believe that it is, that a very analogous thing is going on in religion. There's a gripping power of religious experience that involves, I like that you use the word, the numinous, where you just have an experience of reverential awe at something. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a deity. So there are all sorts of nature religions and other religions, but you're overcome by reverential awe. And like laughter, there are physiological signs of this. Your pupils dilate. In some religious traditions, there may be trembling. Religious tradition I'm studying right now, the Pentecostal tradition, has vasodilation and ecstatic speech and fainting. Like laughter, those things are very hard to fake. They can be faked, but they testify to this internal experience, which is motivationally really salient. My own view is you don't have religion without these experiences.
And of course, then the question is, where do these experiences come from? You know, I mean, yes, we have a physiological response, and, you know, I'm sure you could do brain scans during these and, you know, and find something going on, but yeah, that doesn't answer the question of why.
Yeah, so what's really generating the experience?
Right.
So can I tell you a story?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I did my field work at the University of Michigan Biological Station up in northern Michigan. We often see northern lights, but one night it was one of the most dramatic manifestations of the aurora borealis that any of us had ever seen. The giant tongues of multicolored flame were leaping up from the horizon to the middle of the sky, and there's a group of us out on the lake watching it, and one of my colleagues, well known for his atheism, after one particularly spectacular flame, he said, "Whoa, I'm going to church tomorrow." And the whole group burst into laughter. We knew what he meant. We were all experienced this numinosity, and there was this disposition to think that there was something more. So where does it come from? Well, my colleague would say, well, it comes from the radiation display in the sky. And I think that's for sure true. But what do you say if people have those experiences apart from the aurora borealis, if they're sitting in their room and they are overcome by an awareness of a numinous presence? We've got the proximal explanation of the neurophysiological event. I don't think it's a question that science can answer of whether there's a downstream presence really there.
Whether God is there.
Yeah. And if there were a God there, we'd still have the question, is God somehow causally generating that experience, or is he always there? And something within our internal physiology in some people generate moments of awareness of his presence. And if it's the latter case, you don't invoke God as part of the proximal explanation. It's just not a delusion. It's a revelation.
Is this a science question? I mean, can science come to any answer of that dilemma that you pose? I mean, like, you know, essentially, is God there or not?
Well, I think science could answer the question, can we come up with a causally adequate explanation of where the experience comes from? So let's forget the aurora borealis. Somebody's in their room. I'm talking about me, actually.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about you. I mean, does this, I'm guessing there's something from your personal experience.
Okay, yeah. I was not raised in any particular religious tradition, somewhat anti-religious, in a family of German Jewish Holocaust refugees who believed that religion was the source of human ills. Didn't settle the question for me of whether there was a God. And I was reading C.S. Lewis, and I found him unpersuasive and a little irritating that he would think his arguments were adequate. And I read Why I Am Not a Christian.
Bertrand Russell,
unpersuaded. And I actually despaired of reason being able to solve these questions. I was laying in my bed one night and decided to pray to a God who I wasn't sure was there. I give up. Reason's never going to solve it. And in that moment, the most glorious, numinous, loving, overwhelming personal presence that I had ever experienced or even ever imagined flooded my heart and filled the room. And this is not everybody's experience. I understand the rational deficits in such experience, but it was self-authenticating in a way that I could not doubt.
Sounds like it changed your life.
It did. Profoundly changed my life. And I found a narrative to help make sense of that experience, which for me was the Christian faith. And
but you actually are from a Jewish background, a sort of a more or less atheist Jewish background.
My immediate family, atheist, larger family, was practicing, and we were sitting around Passover at my uncle's house, and my uncle loved me dearly, and he says, you know, aren't you betraying your tradition by this move, and what do you need this Jesus person for? And I'll tell you, I had been living a pretty, life on the edge would be an understatement. My dad jumps in and he says, Gary, that's enough. I don't know who this Jesus is, but all I can say, the changes he's made in my son's life, God bless him. So, in any case, this is a little of a diversion, but to your question, could science explain that experience? And if it did, would it remove the warrant for believing that the experience was in any way truth-tracking or revealed anything about the truth of things? And I think I really believe that science could come up with a proximal explanation of what my brain was doing.
So it might. Science could maybe figure out what triggered this obviously, something happened in your brain to be able to have this experience, but not necessarily the ultimate cause of the trigger.
Yeah. So, I don't want to nuance this too much, but I'd say there are three questions. Set aside the trigger for just a moment. Mm-hmm. Science could certainly explain what was happening in my brain during the experience, where these feelings came from, what part of the brain is it that actually perceives not just agency, but experiences personhood. And by the way, I think that's a fascinating question itself. The next question is the trigger, not what mediated the experience, but what caused these events in the brain. And I think science could explain that if there is a proximal cause. And, you know, maybe it was something I ate or some developmental cascade that culminated in that moment. I'm open to the possibility that maybe the trigger wasn't natural. Maybe there is a divine decision. I'm going to give this experience to Jeff. If that's the case, I don't think science could explain it. I have colleagues who are committed to the proposition, not just of methodological naturalism, that we seek for a natural explanation to everything, but they're a priori committed that there is a natural explanation for everything. And I don't see any reason for that commitment. And then the last question is, okay, so let's come up. Let's say we do come up with an explanation. It was a drug that Jeff took or something he ate for dinner, like Scrooge thought when he saw the ghosts. Well, we still have could science say anything about the ultimate cause, about whether or not there was in fact an intelligent, loving being who so constructed well, no, science can't say anything about that one way or another. Science can come up with discoveries and descriptions of the world that seem to comport or not comport with the idea of a loving, moral, intelligent creator. But science can't adjudicate whether such a creator actually exists.
Oh, this has been fascinating. Yeah. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Steve.
That's Jeff Schloss talking with Steve Paulson. He's a professor of biology at Westmont College in California. This episode was produced in partnership with the Center for Humans and Nature. The center brings together scholars from a diversity of disciplines to think creatively about our relationships with nature and each other. And you can read Jeff's essay on evolution and morality and share your own thoughts at humansandnature.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio and distributed by these folks.
PRI, Public Radio International.